From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
I'm glad to be here. I spent an hour at Wilson High School this morning with some very inquisitive senior kids, so I'm exhausted.
I missed your column in The Current this week. What did you write about?
You know, I don't think about these columns. I write them and forget
That's
them.
That's why I asked you about this.
It was something very important. It had to be or said.
Our guest today is David Grosso. He is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. David Grosso is an independent. David Grosso, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kojo. Good to be here.
Tom Sherwood, you know who said this as soon as I say it. He has promised a vicious campaign, according to the Washington Post, in 2018 against Senator Tim Kaine, a popular former governor who is seeking a second term in the Senate. And you know, if we say he's going to be running a vicious, if he says he's going to be running a vicious campaign, you should know that we are talking about none other than Corey Stewart, who wants to run for governor of Virginia next year, but the leadership of the Republican Party.
You know, Senate, U.S. Senate.
U.S. Senate against
him. He ran for governor, almost won.
Almost won the primary. But it would appear that the Republican Party establishment is not in favor of Corey Stewart running. Why would that be?
Well, this, you know, this is like throwing Corey Stewart into the briar patch. I mean, he's very happy that Republicans are nervous that he's the candidate and they want somebody a little more mainstream like Ed Gillespie, who just lost. You know, Corey Stewart from Prince William County, where I think he's in his fourth term there. He's very popular there. But he said he's not going to let the Mitch McConnell bozos, which is,
well,
no, we've got to have.
Imagine if he wins, this is somebody he'll have to be working with in the Senate.
No, he likes to say he's Trump before Trump, and that Ed Gillespie lost because Ed Gillespie tried to mute his campaign and try to reach middle of the road people, and the Trump people just didn't turn out for him because of that. So Corey Stewart's running. The Republican Party, the place to be this weekend in Virginia is at Hot Springs. It's about 4 hours down the road, 81 down there in the mountains, where the Republicans are having an advance. They don't call it a retreat anymore, but it's an advance.
Remember who used to do that too?
Yes, Marion Barry.
Exactly right.
He said, I'm not retreating. I'm having an advance. What do you mean retreat? And that's basically where they are. You know, Mr. Whitbeck, the state party director, told us on this show, you know, that we got to recalibrate our message. We cannot do what we did in 2017 and 2018. So that's it. So the Republican establishment, if you want to call it that, looking at several people, maybe Jim Gilmore, the former governor who also ran for president, but that might be a retread kind of candidate. There's also looking at Nick Freitas from Culpeper, who is a Army Green Beret, conservative, family guy, in the state house, who might be a candidate, and all that's going to be playing out this weekend in Hot Springs, Virginia.
But the biggest thing that's going to be playing out this weekend is how do they recover from the shellacking that they took in the recent General Assembly.
Oh, yeah, that's the whole, yeah. And this is the president, the Senate campaign against Tim Kaine, who starts out very strong. They've got some work to do.
And a part of that work has to do with whether or not the Republicans will maintain control of the General Assembly. Democrats have now asked for a new election to fill the seat vacated by retiring Speaker William Howell. Remember, there was only like an 82-vote difference between the Republican and Democrat in that race, and there were errors that led 147 voters to cast ballots in the wrong race. And so Democrats this Wednesday filed an amended complaint, and they want a new election to take place there. If they win that election, that would that give them control of the General Assembly, or it would
well,
be
there are
50,
three or
50?
Four seats in the in the House. You know, 100 seats in the House. It was 64-66-34, and then after the election with these disputed seats, it's 51-49 now. And either one or two changes here, and some recounts that are later this month, or this lawsuit could flip it to the Democrats. The Republicans are going ahead like they're going to be in charge, but it's going to be very narrow. I think, you know, Judge T.S. Eliot, in the federal judge who's looking at this, is looking at that seat down in near Fredericksburg, Stafford County. I was looking at the judge. He's a Harvard, Oxford guy. He used to be at Hunton & Williams, which is a big law firm. He was appointed by Reagan in 1987. He's just an interesting person. I'm going to be very interested to see how he plays this from what the law says about do they have a whole new election. The Democrats are asking that this election, because there were some disputed votes, people voted in the wrong campaign because of some errors by the elections board, do you have another election? And that would just throw more turmoil into the Virginia General Assembly, which actually starts, you know, in January.
We'll have to see how it turns out. Our guest in studio is David Grosso. He is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He's an independent. He's also chair of the Committee on Education. So if you have questions about anything having to do with education, Ballou High School, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Before we get to school issues, Tom Sherwood, it would appear that the council has won a victory of sorts over who's going to redevelop those four, I think there are four historic properties in Anacostia. There was some dispute between the mayor and the council over who had the authority to do it. The D.C. council wanted one particular organization to do it. The mayor said no, she wants to look at it. However, she has apparently decided that she's going to go along with the council and transfer the houses to the L'Enfant Trust, D.C.-based nonprofit that specializes in historic preservation projects and previously restored two other historic houses in Anacostia. Does this mean this was a victory for David Grosso and Phil Mendelson?
Well, I don't know much him, but maybe Phil Mendelson, the council chairman. I mean, this is the way politics works. The chairman and the council had said that they wanted these four historic homes, which have been in disrepair for years, and it's a shame that they've been this way for so long. They wanted to give it to, as you said, the L'Enfant Trust. The mayor's office said, well, wait a minute. No, I'm the mayor. My administration controls the distribution of government property, and that we will take care of this. And so there's been this fight between the mayor and the chairman. And so, but she has, this past week or whenever she did it, has said that she's proposed legislation and will do exactly what the council wants. What she's trying to do is maintain her authority as the mayor and her administration. And what this does for both of them is it gets this embarrassing dispute off the table for 2018, where she's running for re-election, he's running for re-election. And people in Anacostia deserve better treatment for those houses. And there's a lot going on in Anacostia, and this firm says that this nonprofit, L'Enfant, will get these houses, will restore them at its cost, and make them available for workforce residents to own them. It's all good. It's good that the mayor and the chairman have set this aside. Maybe our guest has a view of this.
David Grotto, did the mayor cave to the council?
You know, it's about time that we finally get these buildings fixed up. I mean, and this is not just this mayor and this council chair. I mean, these have been in the portfolio of the District of Columbia for a very long time, have fallen apart. I've been out and seen these buildings. They are an embarrassment that the District of Columbia owns this property and has left them in their disrepair for all this time in the middle of these neighborhoods in historic Anacostia. I think that there's a win-win here. The mayor gets to claim that she is the one that's moving these forward, and her authority is the one that approves it to dispose of these properties to L'Enfant Trust. L'Enfant Trust gets to do what they do best, which is to renovate these buildings and bring them back to their historic quality. And the chairman also gets to move forward with what his priority was. So I think everybody wins.
He mentioned the mayor about getting, you know, trying to preserve her way. You know, there's some people think you're going to run for mayor. Are you running for mayor?
Some people. Harry Jaffe.
Well, I didn't want to mention his name, but
who's that?
He's some has-been writer.
Who co-wrote a book with Tom Sherwood.
Who wrote a book with me, but, you know, I had to spend my whole time correcting his version of it. Anyway, Harry Jaffe says you should run for mayor. Should shake things up. Even if you lose, you'll raise your profile. You'll put the mayor on point. So this is the Politics Hour. Are you going to run for mayor?
But it is a Politics Hour, and I have to tell you what happened there. What happened was Harry
Jaffe. That would be a yes or no, and then you can fill us in.
Harry Jaffe spends a lot of time out in rural Virginia, near Winchester, Virginia. My sister Christine.
He has some family matters.
Yes, my sister Christine owns the Winchester Book Club in Winchester, downtown Winchester, Virginia, and he shops there on a regular basis. And I think that my wonderful younger sister has convinced him that maybe this is a good idea. She didn't talk to me ahead of time. She didn't talk to my staff or anybody else. I actually think that Mayor Bowser is doing a good job, and I have no intention of running against her.
Well, there's some news right there. Not that he's not running, but that Mayor Bowser is doing a good job. You said you just endorsed her for re-election.
I think she's doing a good job.
But what about your colleague, Vince Gray, is agonizing?
The news for me is that this wasn't Harry Jaffe's idea after all.
I also believe that Chairman Gray, Vincent Gray, Councilmember Gray, Mayor Gray, is doing a great job right now as the head of the Committee on Health. And I really love working with him and working in Ward 7. And, you know, we do a lot of stuff around health for students in the schools lately on mental health as well as physical health issues with the nurses in the schools. And I just think he's doing a wonderful job. So let's talk about your job.
Just wrap up politics. Have you told him this, and what does he tell you?
We talk all the time, and I always tell him that.
What does he tell you about whether he'll run for mayor? He hadn't said yes or no. He's looking at it.
Come on. You've done this a long time. He doesn't tell anybody anything for a long time. He hasn't told me anything.
Okay, good enough.
You chair the Education Committee. Schools Chancellor Antoine Wilson reassigned the principal at Ballou Senior High this week. A WAMU investigation found the school graduated students who were chronically absent and seniors who did not meet graduation requirements. Teachers said they were pressured by administrators to pass students. There are some teachers at Ballou who say they've been trying to get folks to pay attention to this issue for some time, and that it wasn't until this showed up in the news that you paid attention. How would you respond to the notion that it took a news report to force any kind of action or any kind of oversight over this?
Yesterday I had a hearing, a youth hearing. It's my annual hearing, which actually originally was Vince Gray's idea, and I've taken his idea in the Committee on Education. And at the hearing, we had a couple of students come out and testify about their experience at Ballou High School. And one of the things that really struck me was one of the students, Amaya, she noted that it feels like Ballou is always the poster child of what DCPS does wrong and how DCPS has failed everybody. And I have to say, I knew about this before there were news reports coming out that people were going to have issues with the way this was approached. And for me, though, it was very important for us to celebrate the successes. And the success here is that, no, not every student graduated who could have graduated from Ballou. In fact, only 60-some percent of the students did graduate. But the success is that all of the students that graduated, they all did apply for college for the first time in the history of Ballou, and all of them were accepted. Now, that does not mean that they all had to go through a rigorous exam to get accepted. Some students with a high school diploma can get into a school and be accepted, and maybe they don't even attend. There are nuances here that are very important. I also think it's important for us to note that the District of Columbia has had issues with attendance across the board. It is not just a Ballou High School situation. In fact, we continue to work on this. We have a task force that is between the mayor and the council and all the agencies that talks about this on a monthly basis. The reality is that it's very difficult, I think, for students to always fit into the rigid schedule that you have at a particular school. And it's important for us to recognize that we have to continue to give opportunities for students and not continue to put them down. And, you know, this was an opportunity for them to celebrate something that they had accomplished. And frankly, you know, I think that it would be important for us to look at this more broadly. We're going to hold a hearing on December 15th about the more broad graduation requirements and credit recovery issues. The chancellor will come before us. The state superintendent will come before us. And we'll dig into this question.
And when you say
you're
looking at the broader issues, you mean that this is not going to be focused only on Ballou High School. It will look at the DCPS as a whole.
Kojo, I think it's unfair to focus just on Ballou High School in this situation. I think Ballou High School has some wonderful things going on there that we need to celebrate. I do think, though, that it's a constant question on whether or not we are preparing students for college, for career. And, you know, the reality is that there was some alignment by some people to the Park results. And, you know, these are the testing results that that everyone has to take now. It's been 3 years in the Park. This is a misnomer to say that just because students are not scoring fours and fives on the Park scores that they shouldn't graduate. There are people that are doing well on the Park but not getting the highest score. It's just that's what we're trying to get to. That's our goal.
But Mr. Councilmember, The mayor, after she had a press conference with the chancellor saying they were going to take a look at this and look at the broader issue, you know, she did say it made her heart sick that this has happened at Ballou and that the students have not been served well by being treated this way, and she wants it fixed. Now, that you, people say that's politics or whatever, but she seemed to say it like she felt, and I think you do too. There's a danger, though, isn't there, if you say, well, we won't focus in on Ballou, we'll look at the big picture, when in fact the NPR WAMU investigation was pretty detailed about there was no follow-up when kids didn't come to class. They stayed in the gym all day. There was no management of the classes or to have people come in and clear the gymnasium. There may be citywide problems with the way we do grades and attendance, but isn't there something you can say, at Ballou, we're no longer going to allow this? I know people who would go to Wilson and their parents, and they say if their kids are out even a few days, they get a follow-up email or phone call. They get it with a threat, and somebody will come to their house and say, where's your child? There's aggressiveness about getting them there, and there are all kinds of socioeconomic issues about why kids don't come, up to and including they don't want to come in some cases. But the overall serious issues, shouldn't you address the Ballou problems while you look at their broader picture and let it just be subsumed into a general policy?
Well, I believe that there is going to be a deep dive into the Ballou questions, and that's going to be done by the Office of the State Superintendent, who's hired an outside firm to do this. There's going to be a deep dive also by the Chancellor about what is permitted, what isn't permitted when it comes to credit. You know, the fact is that these students
and fixes made,
and there needs to be fixes made, okay. But I think that we're doing a disservice if we don't recognize that this is something we've been struggling with for a long time, and that, you know, the reality is that the one moment when Ballou has a positive story to tell, we decide that we're going to rain on their parade. And
what do you mean? Oh, you sound like you're being critical of the news media for looking at Ballou.
Absolutely, I am. I think that there is a mistake here to go after Ballou High School again on this issue when, in fact, there are plenty of examples throughout time where these mistakes have happened, and that's part of what school reform is all about.
But we're trying to fix this. The WAMU and NPR, as I understand it, went, quote, after the story because teachers and former teachers at the school themselves, more concerned about the school than the image of the school, said this has got to be fixed. And so it was a legitimate story because the people who worked there were upset about it and say
I'm not saying it's not a legitimate story. Okay. Don't mischaracterize it. I'm saying that it just frustrates me that this is always going to come down on Ballou. I believe that we could have done a study.
You know of any other school that has horrific 30-day, 60-day absences and graduations?
Absolutely. And I think that we will be digging into that at the hearing, and we will be talking about that on the 15th.
You know of them yourself.
We have data that we're looking at to find this, and I'm not going to call schools out
right
now.
Well, is it possible that the celebration is what attracted the attention?
I think it was, Gojo, but we celebrate all the time positive things happening at other schools, and this doesn't come down on them like this. Look, I'm not saying there's not an issue there or that I'm not concerned. I am very concerned. It's why I wanted to be the chair of this committee to start with. There are students that are leaving our high schools not prepared for college or their career. That is a reality, though, in and of itself.
Put on your headphones, please, because Richard in Northeast Washington wants to talk about Ballou. Richard, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Hi, Richard. Are you there? Richard, we can't hear you right now. Are you there? Richard is not... apparently there. Initially, the chancellor said he had no plans to remove the principal. Do you know what changed?
I think what he decided was that, and you'd have to talk to him about this directly, but what he decided was to give her a time away from the school so that they could do the investigation without any appearance of interference. She is still with the DCPS. She is in central office for a 45-day period. But let me tell you, the students are very upset here. And one of the students said to me yesterday at the hearing, when the teachers that left came out with this and when the reporters did all this work, nobody took into consideration how they would feel, how the students would feel. They said over and over again in this hearing last night that they're really upset and that nobody seems to care what they think, and no one has asked them what they think.
Well, what do they think? You must have asked them. But their feelings might be hurt if their school is held up to such embarrassment. But is that a reason? I mean, what is the suggestion? What did they tell you at this hearing? Do they not want it? Shouldn't have been done?
These students said that there are lots of situations in their building where they are in the class or when they're in the building, when they're not being counted as being present, which we're going to investigate. I think that is a problem. I think there are confusions about the 80-20 rule, which is gets into the weeds a little bit. But the reality is that if you're missing 20% of the class of the day, then you're marked as absent for the whole day. We tried to amend that a couple years ago through legislation. There's some confusion about when a student goes to another assignment, maybe goes to band practice or goes to somewhere else, that then they're marked as absent. And, you know, frankly, these students are telling me yesterday that since Dr. Reeves came in 3 years ago, there has been a shift in the way that that school has been run and that there's been positive. And a couple of these young women said they've never felt so welcome in the school and that they think things are going in the right direction at Ballou.
I think people agree with that. I mean, let's stipulate there are...
We got 30 seconds.
There are very good teachers and there are great administrators, and then there are terrible situations where people don't follow the rules and they end up with the story that has been made such...
That's news. True, Tom. We're going to get to the bottom of this, though, and I think it's important...
It's not an either-or. It's both.
It's not. And I'm not saying that because I think that this is a broader problem, we're not going to investigate and really understand what's going on. You know, there are some issues that need to be, you know, really analyzed, and we're going to do that on the 15th.
The student has worked hard, also is embarrassed because she will be from, or he will be from Ballou, and
that's
then
right.
They'll feel like they didn't get proper treatment.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue this conversation with David Grosso. He's an at-large member of the D.C. Council and an independent. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back to the Politics Hour with Tom Sherwood. He's our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Our guest, David Grosso. He's an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He is an independent. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Before we do, and staying with education, Mr. Grosso, you proposed ending out-of-school suspensions. What would that legislation do, and what are the alternatives for discipline in schools?
Kojo, over the summer, we were able to work in multiple times with a big working group to discuss a reform to discipline in schools in the city. The reality is that pushing students out of school for minor things is not productive. It doesn't help the school environment, doesn't help the student, and it certainly doesn't help society. So the bill that I introduced with the help of a lot of people is the Student Fair Access to School Act, which will do two main things. It will limit out-of-school suspensions for students up to eighth grade, only to things where there's a physical altercation, some kind of physical fight or something like that, or some extreme mental kind of intimidation or threats. And then it will also ban suspensions and expulsions in high schools for minor things. So the schools will be able to build out discipline policies. They will then be – basically what I'm trying to do is remove all of the subjective things that you might expel a student. One of the things we found out with the data that we've collected over the last 3 years is that an African-American student in the District of Columbia is 7 times more likely to be suspended than a white student.
Where did that come? Just the statistics?
This is the statistics. The data that we've collected, the first act I ever did as a council member was amend a bill to include collecting of data of suspensions and expulsions across all sectors. So this data now is about 4 years in, and it's very robust, and we found that there's a disparity there. I'm not surprised. I wish I was surprised, but the fact of the matter is that when you push a child out, you're basically saying to her, you know, you're not worth it for us to make the effort. So
You're too much trouble.
The alternative is to do restorative justice practices that embrace the child, find out what's going on that maybe makes that child act out or not, and then give her an opportunity to be held accountable in a more meaningful way in the school.
Apparently, this legislation also says schools must continue the education for students while they are suspended and have a reintegration plan for students to return successfully to school. How are they supposed to do that?
So the thought I had there was, you know, if you're putting the child out, their education, the fact that they are owed an education in the District of Columbia doesn't stop just because you put them out. And there's too many times when the student is suspended and not given any classwork to do while she's at home, and returns to school in a much worse position. And, you know, this really came close to me when I was working with a group called Free Minds here in D.C. who works with youth that are incarcerated as adults doing poetry work. And you talk to these youth when they come back from Bureau of Prisons, and they're in their mid-20s at this point usually, and you ask them, well, what was the factor that really pushed you out? And they said, well, after I got my second or third 10-day suspension in a row and school, I figured that I was no longer welcome. And usually that was in middle school. That was not in high school. And they can really trace it back to there. And I'm trying to do my best in the position that I'm in to end the school-to-prison pipeline. And I think that this legislation will get us closer to that.
How would that physically work? Because it seems to me, it sounds like common sense that you would want somebody, even if he or she were acting out, to be in a position where you still have some kind of control or at least observation of them. So in your view, if you had your way in the school, so if a person is not suspended, they are just maybe suspended from their class and they must go to other classes, but what if they just don't go? I mean, again, it's got to be some kind of carrot and stick reason.
Well, there are ways to
hold. How do you
deal
with somebody who feels alienated from the school and then you put them where in the school?
There are examples of how this has worked, not in other jurisdictions as much as here in the District of Columbia. I go around and talk to teachers who have said, you know, and principals who have said, I'm not going to do suspensions anymore. And I say, well, what do you do with them? And she said that they have to double down on the behavioral health techs. They have to double down on support services so that when a student is acting out, you don't take that student and say, here, go figure it out on your own on the street.
And you get teachers themselves can actually do more by just simply talking to a student,
yes,
and getting him or her to feel like somebody at this school cares about me,
cares
even
about
if I'm
me.
Acting out.
Right. And in the end, it's not about saying continue in that classroom necessarily. It might not be a safe space to do that. You need to maybe separate the child out for a couple hours, really understand what's bugging that kid. And in the past in schools, we just didn't always ask that question. And when you ask the question, you usually figure it out, especially the younger kids. You know, the younger kids are going to tell you what's going on, and then maybe the government has an obligation to step in and help there.
Right.
Want to get beyond school issues, but before we do, here are a couple of responses to the situation we've been talking about at Baloo. First, there is an email from Marie who says, I'm extremely disappointed that David Grosso chose to criticize WAMU and NPR for their Pulitzer-worthy coverage of the scandalous situation at Baloo. Mr. Grosso missed the point. Baloo received positive publicity for getting all its graduates accepted into college while not making any effort to ensure they'd actually be ready for college. Almost none of those accepted into college actually attended. I hope this important story will help D.C. policymakers understand that feel-good gestures are not what we need. What we need is the difficult, expensive work of making sure that kids get to school and learn when they are there. I'm sorry to hear that the chair of the Education Committee does not understand that, but I'm hoping he will rethink his criticism. He owes it to the children of D.C. And then there's Dave in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Dave, your turn.
Hi, Tojo. Thanks for taking my call. This is a issue that really impacts me a lot as a local business owner.
I do understand that, but please try to be as brief as possible.
Yes. Basically, I hire local young people, and work attendance issues is probably my number one issue. And if this is a skill that they could be teaching better in the schools, it's going to impact local businesses. You know, I know people that own businesses in the surrounding suburbs.
And they want people to be early, they want people to be on time, and this is not what seems to be happening at Baloo. And David Grosso, it's not that simple, is it?
Kojo, it isn't that simple. And if I could get anybody to show up on time, it would be my own colleagues to meetings that we're having. But
should be fine, but that's a different story.
Let's just say to Marie's thoughts on this, I think it's very important to respond. What I'd like to dig into is what does it mean to be ready for college, and who really is preparing who to be ready for college, which is what her point was about. And the fact is that to pick out on Baloo alone is unfair. And I'm not saying we shouldn't look at Baloo. I agree. We need to dig into what's going on. But let me tell you, that is not the only place where students are leaving high school not ready for college in the District of Columbia. And so this is what school reform is all about. And we're trying to make sure that more and more students are ready for college and for career when they leave. But it's going to take time. And to pick out Baloo right now, when Baloo had a positive story to tell, I think was just unfair.
The positive story, though, was not accurate.
But Tom, I think it was accurate that the students that applied all applied for college, and they did get into college. Whether or not they're college ready is a problem, and we need to dig into that, and we're going to dig into that. But you know, I could talk that story about other schools too, and so it's really unfair, in my opinion, to continue to pick on Blue. The one thing that Amaya said yesterday in my hearing, she said, why is Ballou always the poster child for DCPS failure when that is not fair? It makes every one of us in the school feel bad.
Okay, we got to move on. Earlier this week, the D.C. Council voted to tighten the requirements for homeless families seeking shelter, rules that Mayor Bowser sought. You, along with Ward 8 Council Member Trayon White, opposed the new rules. First, remind us of what's changed and what were your issues with the legislation?
Kojo, this is something that it was really hard for me to come to a final vote on, and I have to say I worked closely with the mayor, her team in the Department of Human Services, as well as with Brianna Doe, the chair of the Committee on Human Services. I sit on that committee and, in fact, offered amendments in the committee. And, you know, the reality is that this bill is simply going down the wrong path for me. And it's a fundamental issue around how well do we care for people that need care in the District of Columbia. They are constantly telling me that they are short on money, that they can't afford to cover all of the people that need these services. And I think it's unfair to say that when we have money sitting in savings of over $1 billion, we have constant credits going out to developers for things like underground parking, the tax breaks that we put through last year that I opposed for exemptions on estate taxes or lowering business taxes. I mean, these are things that go directly in contradiction to this bill, which is motivated by trying to save money. I don't think that's appropriate. I think there's also another assumption that I've learned a long time ago is not true. I worked in a homeless shelter for women and children for a year and a half when I was younger in San Antonio, Texas, and not any one of those women chose to come there. They did not say, oh, wouldn't it be great if I was homeless and I could stay in that shelter tonight? And I think that's a false assumption that we have when we're trying to do things like check their IDs and see if they're D.C. residents or determine whether or not they're ever anywhere else they could go that's a safe place to stay. The reality
are you, are you suggesting that if you show up, then you get shelter for the night?
I'm suggesting that,
that you don't have a standard.
Well, I mean, I think you can have a standard, but it doesn't have to be this narrow.
What would the standard be for other than show that you are, in fact, somewhere in the city? What would a standard be that would be acceptable to you other than an open door?
For me, I think you should be required to go through an interview process and understand what your situation is. On any night. And because I think the intake is incredibly important and understand exactly what that person's situation is. The reality is that there are some people that can go back to their home for that night or for another night. My problem is when you just say that you're going to stop doing this because we're short on money at a time in the District of Columbia when we're not short on money. That's not fair.
I'm about to say the beef that you and activists for the homeless have about this has to do with this. The council gave final approval this week to a funding package for developers at Union Market, including some $36 million for a parking lot. This has a lot of residents, in particular supporters of more affordable housing, up in arms. That includes you, apparently. Was this money, in fact, diverted from affordable housing funding?
That $36 million could have gone towards affordable housing. And in fact, my colleague Alyssa Silverman and I offered an amendment that was rejected by the council to expand affordable housing requirements at Union Market as opposed to putting in more parking. And underground parking is the most expensive type as well. But there's an irony here, and I think it's important for us to point that out. On the same day that we're voting on, you know, narrowing the door for people to get into homeless services, we are saying to a developer who is not even from the District of Columbia, here's another $36 million for parking that you don't even need. You haven't proven it, and you don't need it.
This is a $13 billion government. It spends money on economic development, which is what people would say that underground parking is. It doesn't mean that if you spend $34 or $36 million for underground parking at Union Market, where the ultimate plan is to have 6,000 housing units there, it doesn't mean you can't spend money on more money on homelessness.
Except for this, Tom. Activists argue that money is not needed by the developers at Union Market because that development was going to take place anyway.
It's happening on the same day that you're voting on narrowing the door for purposes of not enough money. This is the irony. Maybe you're right. Maybe you could do it all. I'm fine with that. But the fact is,
I don't think the mayor's position is we don't don't have enough money to do the homeless policy that we have right now. I don't think that's the principal argument. I think the principal argument is we want to serve as best we can the people who are in the city who lose their homes. We want to give them wraparound services. I can't believe I'm speaking on behalf of the mayor.
You're doing a good job. You're doing a good job.
But I'm saying what the mayor's position is that if we better understand who's coming into our shelters with some standard, and I think she had two or three, it's down to one. Now, you must show that you were in some way in the District of Columbia couch surfing somewhere.
Well, can I just say, before we go too far down that path, I understand what you're saying, but the fact is that there is now a section in this bill that shifts the burden on presumption of safe housing from the government saying that you do have it to you saying I need it and I don't have safe housing.
I know it's going to, you know, and if we get through and if we get through a terrible winter and the mother and a child is found to be frostbitten and or dies in the cold city, then who knows what will happen.
Take that.
But the larger point here is that $34 million for parking in Union Market off of Florida Avenue is not keeping the city from spending X dollars on.
But it's priorities. No, and what I'm saying is that you can't tell me.
Why don't you spend $150 million for a soccer stadium? Why don't you dump that out?
Well, yeah, I think that was a priority at the time that we decided to do, but I don't think that this is necessarily the time. And let me just be clear. I didn't vote against the Union Market deal. I actually supported it because of the infrastructure that needs to get done.
Overall,
I just think it's important to point out the irony.
My view is that you have a budget large enough, and the money that's in the $1 billion plus that you've mentioned, some of that is used to guarantee other money, so it's not all available. But the fact is, the city has enough money. This is the unique thing about the district now, as opposed to 20 years ago. There is money in the budget that can be aggressively used to address virtually every problem we discussed this morning.
Can I just say one thing
on this? Maybe you should run for mayor. And then you could write the budget.
I was there in 2001 when we had the revitalization effort began under Tony Williams.
Your staffer.
And I was a staffer for Sharon Ambrose at the time. And I bought into the idea that if we brought more residents here, if we built buildings and we did more development, that we would have more money for the poor and more money to give services to the poor.
That's true. It's happened.
And to a certain extent, it has happened. But we also did a tax revision commission that lowered taxes across the board. We have also done more and more investments and subsidies for developers without getting what we need out of it. Why do we still have a housing crisis? Why don't we have a grocery store east of the river? What is going on here is not enough. I think we need to be spreading this money out better. I think we need to stop giving tax breaks and start taking care of
the
poor.
Well, the council could put money and put at Skyland and put a grocery store there if you can find a developer to build one.
Almost out of time, but the council
We've got too many things to discuss.
Council also passed this week a measure to block insurance providers in the district from charging additional fees for preventive women's health care. This was in anticipation of possible rollbacks on rules under Obamacare. However, can that legislation pass congressional review?
Well, you know, we've had a lot of bills that have really gone through congressional review to protect a woman's right for reproductive health, including the Reproductive Health Non-Discrimination Act most recently, where Congress has tried to shut it down and has been unsuccessful.
Congress is such a mess. They can't do anything.
I'm really excited that my colleagues took this on. I know Councilmember Allen took the lead to get it done and really impressed by that and very excited that we are going to continue to respect a woman's right for reproductive health services in the District of Columbia.
Believe it or not, that's all the time we have unless you have a very brief question.
Maryland's having a terrible time funding or putting marijuana in its health clinics. Are we having any problems in the district?
We have plenty of supply. The problem is we don't have enough people that are actually going out and purchasing it because it's too restrictive right now in the District of Columbia. I have a bill that already had a hearing in the Committee on Health to expand the opportunity for people to use medical marijuana.
How about a bill to help Maryland with their supply? But that's another story.
Yeah, you know, you can't cross lines. Paul Zuckerberg, the marijuana advocate, was saying you can't cross state lines.
David Grosso is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me here. Kojo and Tom, always enjoy
Next time
it.
He has to be a lot
That's
calmer.
It for the show today, but there's always more happening online. Follow us on Twitter. Like us on Facebook, where we stream live video every Friday. We do the Politics Hour with Tom Shore. Don't forget to meet us back here Monday. We'll be talking with outgoing D.C. Water General Manager George Hawkins about the region-wide debate over stormwater runoff and infrastructure and the area's biggest environmental challenges. Until then, have a great weekend. Tom Shore, would you do the same?
You too.
I'm Kojo Namdi.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button and thanks.